I didn't see it coming. Fall of 1997. I'm out with the band. We're, you know, stretching out, warming up. One of the athletic administrators said, hey, I gotta tell you about something. By the end of the day today, they're going to break the news that Boston University is discontinuing the football program. I told the band, listen, I don't know if this is the end of marching band at Boston University, but all I can do is promise you that on Monday morning, I am going to begin the fight of my life to keep this band going.
Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of the Bandwagon Podcast for the week of May 13th, 2024. On this edition of the program, news and notes from the band world, including new band programs and experienced percussionists, some thoughts about something Richard Sargent said last week, another internet rabbit hole of the week from across the pond, and I have a conversation with an old friend. He's not old. We're not old. I am not old. I am, rather, your host, Rob Hammerton. Hello, dear listener. Sorry, I got a little defensive there. But I did meet this week's conversation partner long enough ago that, well, there was no such thing as a band meme. Anyway, this episode is genuinely all over the place, anywhere from silly stories to great heights of music making to very sobering topics. There's something for everybody, I guess. So, okay, let's track down that half-empty bottle of valve oil, and away we go. Let's play the first strain. In this episode's first strain, news and notes from the band world. Dateline, Rio Grande, Ohio. Credit to the reporting of WOWK-TV, a CBS affiliate station, and the Highland County Press, both located in Hillsborough, Ohio. Late last month, officials from the University of Rio Grande and Rio Grande Community College announced plans to revive the institution's football program and to launch a new marching band to go with it. This venture will be the debut of a Red Storm football team, as Rio's mascot was still the Redmen the last time the school had a team 75 years ago, back in 1950. Rio Grande Community College had not yet been founded, and the university was still Rio Grande College. In March 1950, the school's board of directors dropped football for financial reasons. The university plans to begin football competition in fall of 2025 and is currently in negotiations with nearby Jackson County High School in hopes that Rio Grande football can be played at the high school's alumni stadium for at least two seasons before a dedicated stadium can be built on the Rio Grande campus. The Red Storm hopes to join the NAIA's Appalachian Athletic Conference. University President Ryan Smith said that an increase in school enrollment led to new investment opportunities. Athletic Director Jeff Lanham said, quote, "This move signifies our commitment to growth and development, enhancing campus life, and fostering deeper community engagement. With football comes the opportunity to unite our stakeholders and amplify school spirit, while the addition of a marching band further enriches the experience." The school will post head football coach and band director positions immediately, with plans to fill both jobs by this summer. Dateline, Indianapolis, Indiana. The Percussive Arts Society has announced its Hall of Fame Class of 2024. Nominees include four-time Grammy Award-winning drummer, composer, producer, author, and educator Terry Lynn Carrington, percussionist, educator, instrument designer, and the founder of Grover Pro Percussion, Neil Grover, percussionist and professor Beverly Johnston, classical and jazz percussionist, educator, and Percussive Arts Society Lifetime Achievement Award winner Gene Peterzak, and Thomas P. Hannum. Tom Hannum's name is probably the most significant of these five nominees to listeners of this podcast, at the very least because Hannum is the only truly band-affiliated percussionist amongst them. He is a percussion arranger, instructor, and clinician who taught at the University of Massachusetts for 40 years. He is now Associate Director Emeritus of the Minuteman Marching Band and Senior Advisor for the Boston Crusaders Drum and Bugle Corps. Hannum is known for his work with DCI's Cadets, Star of Indiana, Carolina Crown, and Crossman, and is a member of the design team for the Tony and Emmy Award-winning show, Blast. He's a member of the DCI Hall of Fame and the World Drum Corps Hall of Fame, among other recognitions. A small editorial note here. It would take more time than I've got available in this segment for me to add my own personalized congratulatory thoughts about Tom And yeah, I call him Tom because, long story short, for most of the last 40 years, it's been my pleasure to say I know him personally, and to say that an awful lot of any success or achievement that I've had in the band arranging sphere can be directly attributed to Tom taking a chance on a then wet behind the ears college band student who thought he might like to get into this arranging thing. Again, story time later. Congratulations now. Meanwhile, back to the Percussive Arts Society story. Their executive director, Joshua Simons, said in a statement, quote, "I'm very excited that PAS will induct these five influential members of the percussion community into the PAS Hall of Fame this year. Their passion and dedication for advancing percussion performance and education make each of them an impressive addition to the Hall of Fame, where they will join nearly 150 other percussion luminaries. These nominees will be officially inducted into the Hall of Fame at the Society's International Conference this November." And that's news and notes from the band world for this week. If you have a news item you think should be included in this segment, send me a link via email to heybandwagon@yahoo.com. Time for a quick water break. I hope you'll meet me on the other side of it. Okay, let's pick it up at the second string. In this week's second strain, a bit of commentary. In last week's trio section, as Richard Sargent and I got to the end of our conversation, he made sort of glancing contact with a topic that quite definitely deserves even more attention than I can give it here in just a few minutes worth of second strain commentary. It's a topic that honestly has been with us for far longer than the most of 7 years since the hashtag MeToo movement kind of blew up. In October of 2017, a lot of people were suddenly inspired to take a long, hard look at how women have been and are treated in entertainment, in lots of areas of society, well, in our society in general, specifically in terms of sexual harassment and abuse. Clearly, here it is, 2024, and we have still not gotten to a satisfying place in terms of dealing with this topic. A few weeks ago, I reported on the end of the legendary Cadets Drum and Bugle Corps organization, an ending that was driven in no small part by the fallout from allegations and litigations surrounding sexual abuse throughout the organization. Again, that's not nearly the only instance of this sort of thing in the band world, but it was the most recent one. Bear with me now. I'm going to back up for a moment, all the way back to fall of 2017. Only a few hours after the very first hashtag MeToo revelations hit news broadcasts and social media on the 16th of October 2017, a good friend of mine, who happens to be a professor at Seton Hall University, not a professor of band, no, but a friend of the arts and education and just basically good behavior, wrote on social media, eloquently, "MeToo isn't just about survivors speaking up. It is about the sheer universality of the experience for women, every woman, every woman you know, every woman you care about. Every woman has experienced either sexual assault or sexual harassment at some time in her life, possibly a lot more than that. We live in a world where this is a universal experience for women, and even if you already knew that in your mind, the gut punch of seeing it everywhere you look in the context of people you love is supposed to be the wake-up call." Unquote. That's exactly what it was, a gut punch, and another, all day on October 16th on social media, post after post. I was not unaware of the problem, I thought, but I, a male person, hadn't taken time to consciously consider that it could be so many people that I knew personally, which means I was unaware of the problem, which means I was some part of the problem. And me writing about how I felt like I'd been punched in the gut was fine, but did it recognize that women who have experienced assault or harassment feel that gut punch over and over? I didn't consciously consider that day, which meant I was another part of the problem. And then I read this tweet from the writer Alexis Benveniste, which I saw not long after I saw my professor friend's post. It said, "Reminder that if a woman didn't post hashtag MeToo, it doesn't mean she wasn't sexually assaulted or harassed. Survivors don't owe you their story." Unquote. Or, as my professor friend continued, "If any woman in your life does not say MeToo, it is not because her life has been free from assault or harassment, it is because she is choosing to not share or because our society taught her that her experiences don't count because other women have had it worse. Our homes, our social spaces, our public spaces, and our workplaces are dumpster fires of men who think they can objectify, commodify, and own women's bodies without fear of legal, social, or professional consequences. It isn't enough to be the guy who doesn't do that. We have to be the guys who see it and demand that other men change." Unquote. On this podcast, from time to time, the subject of gender roles has arisen, quote-unquote, traditional gender roles in the band world, largely focusing on who can be expected or encouraged to play what instrument, or who can be discouraged to play certain instruments or play certain roles. Do only girls play the flute? Do only boys play the trumpet? Are girls encouraged to play the baritone sax in jazz ensembles, but not really to take up other jazz band roles? And yes, I recognize that of late, gender itself has been re-examined. For purposes of this particular topic in this particular moment, I am recognizing this, but I'm limiting my terminology to boys and girls, male and female, just because, well, it's easier to write and narrate with clarity, which, yes, is lazy, but for the moment, let me beg your forgiveness. From early in the planning stages of this bandwagon podcast, I've been looking forward to organizing a musical gender role roundtable discussion for use in a trio section segment, no doubt, but two things encouraged me to broach the subject now, at least in a limited way. One of those inspirations was Richard Sargent's closing thoughts about life lessons learned in band, specifically, treat people with respect. The second inspiration was actually a set of current events that inspired Richard to make that comment. He said so as we chatted, and while I didn't include that in the final edit of the interview, I did say to him at the time that I planned to pursue that topic. That second inspiration, that set of current events, was the recent dismissal of two members of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra in the wake of investigations of them to do with instances of alleged sexual harassment and abuse involving them. Perhaps you may have heard about this via the social media posts of the professional oboist Catherine Needleman. Needleman has decided to pull no punches in her ongoing social media posts about numerous examples of harassment and abuse of women in the orchestral world, as well as many professional orchestras' history of misogyny in their hiring and promotion procedures and results. There's a lot there, which will absolutely not fit into even a complete 50-minute podcast episode, but at the very least, I will include a link in this episode's show notes which will get you to some of Catherine Needleman's writings. They are harrowing, they are impassioned, they are not wrong. Sadly, it rather goes without saying that these problems of the orchestral world have occurred and do still occur in the band world as well. Not to mention my recent observations during conversations I've had with musical colleagues that the large ensemble jazz world may be the last bastion of really obvious male chauvinistic domination, at least as regards the literal ratio of men to women in jazz ensembles, definitely here in the United States at most levels, scholastic to professional, but also internationally. And again, not to cut this short unnecessarily, but this issue is one that is part of the band world, and so needs to be covered as such. I'm still not sure in what form, in the context of this podcast, but I do intend to pay proper attention to it during first and second strains, or in our trio conversation segment, or wherever it makes sense. So here's the call to action. Please do let me know how you think I can do that. In spite of the closing credits things that I say to the effect that any communication you send me, I reserve the right to use on the podcast unless you say otherwise, in this case, I'm more than happy to flip that script. I'll only include your thoughts on the podcast if you specifically tell me that I can. To summarize, I recognize that life is not all sweetness and light. Early this year, I hoped that via this podcast I could build a little band community, and at the time I was thinking of the positive, cheerful, tell-me-your-favorite-silly-band-story side of our activity, and I still am. But the band activity is assuredly not untouched by the hashtag MeToo topic, and it would be naive, or worse, to blunder onward as if it were. So, as they say, we'll talk. More bandwagon in a moment. Okay, let's change keys and get into the trio section. This week in the trio section, hang out of your hats, I think, because my conversation partner is a good friend of mine from a comfortable distance back. There are all kinds of places this chat could go, any one of which will end up being a good old time. We have collaborated on each other's projects pretty often over the last however many years, so this podcast thing is a sort of tag it's your turn situation. And if you, dear listener, have heard episode 9 of this podcast, you will recall the good Dr. Amy McLaughlin of Fitchburg State University mentioning being married to a brass player of our mutual acquaintance, and this is that guy. Welcome to the program, Joe Wright. Hey, Joe.
It's a privilege. Thank you, Rob. Looking forward to it.
And you have made a point of talking about Monday mornings with the podcast, and I don't say that to pump myself up, but I do say that because now I don't have to explain why I've got these opening quick-fire questions.
Right.
First up, what's your primary instrument?
Primary instrument is tuba. It was a little bit of an evolution. I started off on with my dad's trumpet that I found in the attic in fifth grade, and had a little bit of trouble getting up to altitude on trumpet, and for various reasons ended up finding a baritone, and I was taking lessons from a high school student in our neighborhood who was fantastically gifted and patient and really brought me along and helped me really find a rhythm with that. And over the course of middle school, a lot due to my desire to do so, it eventually evolved down to tuba, and that's where it's been, for now going on 50 years.
So, what's your current band-related role?
My current band-related role is I am a band teacher at Chenery Upper Elementary School in Belmont, Massachusetts. This year and this year alone, that school is fifth and sixth grade. It was fifth through eighth grade up until this year. The seventh and eighth grades moved down to a brand new wing in the gorgeous new middle senior high school. And next year, the four elementary schools are sending their fourth graders up into Chenery. So we have this one transition year. And so next year we will start fourth graders. And so that'll be a little different. So I'm in a transition year, but sort of permanent outlook, I am a fourth through sixth grade band teacher.
And it seems to me that that's a sequence of 3 years where, depending on what you teach, that could be a curriculum adjustment every year, or does that?
Oh, certainly. Belmont, I'm very gifted to be able to teach there. It's a real, I'm very fortunate. We're given a fair amount of time and a fair amount of contact time and a little bit of freedom as to how we structure that. I have a co-teacher there. There are two band directors, and that is our only role is band in that school.
It would not be an exaggeration to say that the majority of band directors at the middle and high school level are going to be teaching something other than band as well. It is a rarity that you are just dealing with instruments and nothing else to quote unquote fill out the schedule.
Certainly. And that's certainly been my experience through most of my career until I came to Belmont. And even my first 3 years in Belmont, I was doing some general music as well, but now that's no longer part of our load.
Wow. That sound you hear is a whole lot of people listening going, why can't I have that?
Right. Well, I mean, I was saying that for a long time too. And my previous job was in Andover, Massachusetts. I was there almost 20 years. If I was teaching band, I was doing it in up to eight buildings. And if I was in fewer buildings, then I had a very diverse load and many, many different courses to prepare for. And always in hopes that that would change. And it has since I left. And I think it's possible that Andover and myself were just sort of comfortable in our routine, and it was a really kind of hard to make those changes. And then when I decided to go ahead and take this opportunity, everybody took the chance to make things better, and things are better in Andover, and they have a fantastic team there now. And
Interesting.
yeah.
Well, in your life, what bands have you been active with, whether it's playing or waving a stick in front of or whatever?
Started my band career in the Cape Elizabeth Middle School. Was there for in those bands for almost 4 years. We temporarily moved out to Lake Arrowhead, California. The end of eighth grade for my father, who it was a work situation. And that was a fantastic band situation. It was a smaller band, but the guy was wonderful and he really gave us a lot of attention. And I loved Cape Elizabeth and it was great, but I think that was where I really started to feel encouraged to look at this as something I might do for the rest of my life. And when we got back to Maine, we actually moved to York. And I went to York High School and had a really wonderful band experience for 4 years at York High School. I went to the University of New Hampshire for my undergrad, and I was involved in the wind ensemble there, jazz ensembles, and a little bit begrudgingly got hauled into the marching band. I got my counselors at music camp kind of played a prank on me and told me it was a requirement for music majors, so I signed up. I got to about game three when I re looked around and said, hey, music majors in here. I'm like one of six. But ended up, as you well know, Rob, spending 2 years as drum major of that group towards the end of my time at UNH, and fell in love with marching band. And marching band remained a big part of my band life for decades to follow. My first teaching job was in Waterville, Maine. It was a grade 5 through 12 band job with a couple of other little smatterings of chorus and that kind of thing, but it was mostly band. I loved it. I did it for 4 years. The only reason I left was I wanted to pursue a master's degree and really keep studying tuba on a high level. I went to Boston University for a master's in music education and ended up backing into a situation where I was a graduate assistant with the marching band, and they had a sudden, unexpected personnel change quite early in my time there. And I was asked to hold things together until the end of the season, through the beginning of the sports season, winter sports season. And I ended up being there for 9 years. And that was a wonderful opportunity, and I loved it. And while I was there, I saw it as my life to continue. But every year I was there, and every year away from teaching kids, teaching school-age musicians, I learned more and more firmly that that's where I belonged. And so at the end of the ninth year, still very happy in the job, but still not feeling like it was my path, I accepted that opportunity in Andover, and started at Andover High School and the three middle schools. It was two middle schools at the time. Third one opened in my second year. And my first week was was 9/11. It was an interesting start. And all that that brought, all of the financial situations and everything that we had to weather through. And there was real ups and downs in Andover. And but the community really wanted strong arts and strong music and strong lots of things. And and they encouraged us to really do our best to compete with all the other things. It was very much encouraging. And it was a battle well met, and I enjoyed it. And when COVID hit, I made about four dozen changes in my life of various profundity, but not the least of which was a new position, a new job. And it was a little bit of a risk. Most of those risks worked out fine, but it was a way more change than anybody would recommend you make at one point. So now I'm in Belmont, and now and I'm very, very happy there. I've just finished my fourth year, or finishing my fourth year, and finishing my 36th year in teaching music.
Well, I knew from the get-go that I was going to very selfishly focus at least a part of the conversation about the time at Boston University, at least in part because that's where we met, sorta. And I said that before. And so this is bouncing around in time a little bit. But during your second year as drum major at UNH, I was a drum major at UMass, and our two schools played football. And there was a game where we ended up on the same field at the same time as drum majors of our respective outfits, but I am reasonably sure that we did not actually meet. For whatever reason, we did not send a delegation over, and I have spent a little bit of time wondering what if that had happened.
Right. I know, I have too. I've tried very hard to construct a memory that that's where our friendship began. I have a very clear memory of, I think we went to UMass on the road for both of our away games with UNH. And and so even before you were drum major, we were theoretically sharing fields. But yeah, I think if we're both honest, I don't think we ended up on each other's Christmas card list just that.
No. And long story short, as I was looking for a graduate music education program to be part of, and that is a very long story which will not be told here, we had a phone conversation where you were trying to figure out who the heck I was, and it became clear, oh, our lives did intersect there, sort of. So I'm going to apologize to our listenership, but I'm doing a little bit of time travel here, bouncing back and forth between the BU years that Joe and I shared. I want to bounce forward to, I'm going to guess it was summer of 2001, and we went out to lunch, probably because we hadn't in a while, and you dropped a little bombshell on me that said, well, I'm moving on from BU. And for a split second, I thought, well, that's an earthquake. But the longer we had a conversation, the more sense it made to me.
Well, it was a hard decision to make. It's really hard to justify to myself that, it's not that I was on a bad trajectory. It's not that things weren't going well. It wasn't even that I was unhappy, but it just, as my role at BU developed, I was spending more time with future music teachers. I was teaching classes in secondary methods, in literature and materials. I was bringing folks out to observe classes. I was going out to observe student teachers. And I just, the more I did that, the more I had hard time picturing that I was never coming back to this world. My successor at Boston University was already poised to take over the athletic bands that year, the fall of 2001. And I was going to be moving on to different roles within that, but I'm still going to do the concert band, still teach my classes. And it might even have started to look like I was getting pushed into more of an administrative track. And I think that that on a real level sort of frightened me and felt like I was being pushed off of my path, off of my destiny.
The way you put it was, as we were sitting over food and chatting, was the with every year, the proportion of administration to actual musicians that I'm in front of is starting to swerve in the direction of administration.
Right. And then I was spending less time making music with students. And I just didn't feel like that's what I was supposed to be doing. And there again, I think that I think BU and I were very comfortable with each other, but I think it's also possible that was slowing down the progression and growth of the program. And the music ed program and the band's program both flourished when I left. And I hope it's not because I left, but I think that probably sped things up a little bit. And and that's happened everywhere I've moved on from, and I've never moved on from something without loving what I was leaving, which again is extremely fortunate. Not everybody has that.
So my way back machine can hop back to, yes, perhaps even very close into the moment where I sashayed in your office. I don't sashay anywhere, but and sat down and a couple of folks in the meanwhile have asked me, what was it like to go and know you're going to work for somebody who you graduated college at the same time as? And I always say, okay, so Joe knew what he wanted to do with his life 10 years before I did. And Joe had all kinds of experience that I was going to learn a lot from. And not all of that learning was in the official course syllabus, but and the spoiler at the end, it was great. I spent 3 years in a program which was in good shape and was poised to get better. That was very early in your time there.
Yeah, it was you started the fall of 95, was it?
That's correct.
And that was the beginning of my 4th year. But only my 2nd year as permanent full time. I had the hold it together year. I had the intern while we do a search year, and then I had the we didn't really do a very good search, so you can hang on to it, and I guess we're not gonna look. Maybe that's a little cynical way of looking at it, but I don't think I can claim to have won a national search for that job, is what I'm saying.
Well, I know it's when I walked into the BU rehearsal environment for the first time and saw you for the first time working with a group, I thought this is the right personality for a group. Doesn't take himself too seriously, takes them seriously enough to demand stuff from them, but it was a different, I'm gonna say it was a different vibe than it had been at UMass. And when I was coming to you, I was comparing everything to my time at UMass. And one of the things that I learned was that there are other ways to do it than my first experience of what a great band program is. And they still work, and they work for that environment and for that group of people. And that's okay. That probably set me up for success in my own first band directing, music program directing environment better than had I just done the one thing and taking that with me. It quite honestly opened my eyes to, there is a different way of approaching this, and it ain't wrong. And the way that I learned isn't wrong either, but it might not be a great way for this particular group. It was an eye opener, and I was always appreciative of that.
Well, I'll always be grateful that you did that.
I know there was a rehearsal as we got to the end of football season and toward the basketball and hockey thing, where we were working out of the pep book, and you stopped and looked over at me and said, "With this is my first year. With all the respect in the world to my learned colleague here, I feel like the last time our two bands met, we kind of torched it in the stands." And I said, "You are absolutely correct."
Yeah, right.
Because over there was a program that really threw all of its resources into halftime, and we played. Anybody who's in the band at the time, anyway, will tell you we played a couple of trumpet charges and a couple of trombone charges, and then we just made ridiculous noise, and that was pretty much it. And I drop into a situation where there are two flip folders overfilled with tunes, and I remember looking at it first and thinking, how do they deal with this? And I talk about a learning experience. I learned how they dealt with it. It was part of the game and had been for a long time. All those new experiences, all those opportunities to do, frankly, cool stuff. Because by the time I had been with you for a couple of years, we had hit Macy's, and we were at the first Allentown College show.
Right.
And we were there when BU announced that they were going to not focus on football anymore.
That was a weird, crazy day. I didn't see it coming. And this was fall of 1997. Mm-hmm. I'm out with the band. We're, you know, stretching out, warming up. That was a nice little thing we used to do Saturday mornings at 8 o'clock. We'd go out to the field on game day and we'd be, you know, stretching out and getting ready to do some run throughs in the shadow of three dorms full of people trying to sleep in.
Yes.
So that was, we weren't terribly popular on Saturday mornings, but that's BU culture. That's just the way it goes, folks. And one of the athletic administrators, you know, I was just kind of pacing the sidelines while they're out there stretching and warming up the drum majors, and said, "Hey, I gotta tell you about something. By the end of the day today, they're going to break the news that Boston University is discontinuing the football program." So it wasn't our, you know, it was homecoming. This is not the day we were planning to do this, but it has been leaked to the press. And the outlet that has this information has agreed to wait until after the homecoming game before breaking this news. But that's all they're going to do. So you're going to hear about it. And I wanted to give you a heads up, which was nice that I had the day to think about how I was going to address that with the band. But on the other hand, I had this bombshell in my head while these kids are out there probably losing by 30 points to Villanova or something. It was a rough year for football, which played no small part in that. But the end of the game came and some kids had heard it through some other rumor mill. You know, it was before anybody had cell phones. So we were automatically getting tweets about stuff. And I told the band, the best I could do to prepare this is I said, "Listen, I don't know what this means for the marching band, but I don't know if this is the end of marching band at Boston University, but all I can do is promise you that on Monday morning, I am going to begin the fight of my life to keep this band going." Hmm. And, you know, we left and it was kind of a bummer mood, of course.
Yeah.
And then I thought, how in the world am I going to even start to begin to keep this promise that I just made to them? The weird part of the story, the twist here, is that Monday morning came and I met with the associate dean of the then School for the Arts. And I said, "Has there been any conversation about marching band?" And he just kind of went, "Oh, man, I hadn't thought of that. I don't know what anybody, you know." He said, "Let me make a few phone calls. I will get in touch with you today with anything I know." To move the story along a little bit, every conversation I had was similar to that. This, they hadn't even occurred to them and anything like that. The athletic director was getting involved with the dean and everything. And the bottom line is the conversation about the marching band going away never came.
Hmm.
Only conversations people are having is, "Yes, we're going to have a marching band. Let's figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to keep it." You know, so there was no fight. And that was 100%, as far as I'm concerned, on those kids. You know, that that band had developed a culture that even without football, everybody just assumed that that marching band was a part of Boston University culture. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it was. And, you know, mm-hmm. when the fall of 1998 came, we were billing ourselves tongue in cheek as the finest NCAA soccer marching band in the nation. And we did. We went to 5 or 6 soccer games for both the men and the women. And we had the freedom to build a schedule to do whatever exhibitions and trips we wanted to do. And the only real major challenge for us at that point was recruiting, because no one's going to assume that the school that just ditched football is going to have a marching band. And it was entirely up to us to make sure we got the word out. And that, you know, we took a little bit of a dip in numbers, but I think by the time I left, we were back up to about where we were.
It's not like we went from 80 to 30.
Right, right. And I mean, in 96, that was probably the biggest band that we had because it was Macy's year. And, you know, we were up around 100 then. I think 30% of us color guard, but that's all right. But I'm very proud of that. But I'm proud on behalf of the students for that their involvement in campus to that point had been, of course, the band's going to keep going.
Yeah.
Just how.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I really wasn't ready for that. I was ready to have to make a million begs and pleads, and you need to know how important this is, and they were telling me that. So
the football decision, as soon as I heard it, I thought to myself, well, football's not the moneymaker. Hockey is the moneymaker.
Right.
So as that's going on, I was thinking the same thing, I suppose. Well, what's another sport with a field? Soccer, I suppose. And so, you know, we can just tell the drum line to keep playing. Just
right.
Play, just...
There are no NCAA rules for bands at soccer games.
No.
We just mimic world-class soccer. You know, you get fans out there that are making noise for all 90 minutes in play, and nobody ever told us not to.
And we went down to Foxborough and played for a game or two of the New England Revolution, and that was fully on display, and we were competing with people.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we were trying to keep up with all the vuvuzela and joint compound bucket ensembles.
This is another time travel story, but it relates. Back in the fall, I remember seeing publicity about BU wanting to do an alumni hockey band thing. And there was also the thought that you were going to be on the grounds as a guest conductor. And at that point, I thought, oh, well, I'm there. I mean, that's an easy one. Long story short, and I can let you tell stories of that for sure. But as I arrived and I just was looking around and seeing not only the kids who are recently graduated as of, you know, a year or two or three, which is largely the demographic for a lot of alumni bands around homecoming time.
Right.
I was looking around and seeing people that I recognized. And that means they went back 25, 30 years.
And more. Yeah. There were a good handful of people that predated my era. That was great. It's not the first time they've done this. I mean, we used to encourage alumni to help us fill holes during, you know, winter break and that kind of stuff. We didn't have a specific, this is an alumni day. The current director, Aaron Goldberg, started doing a strictly alumni band, you know, I mean, and, but he would just direct it. And I think a combination of his suddenly not being available for this year's, and you know what, maybe we should see if we can get Joe Wright to do it, you know, and maybe that's a good thing to do anyway, or I'm not sure, you know, exactly sure. But so they talked to me in the fall, and I was pretty nervous. I was, you know, I mean, it's a different protocol, but I had lots of support, and it was really great. And you were there. I think it worked very well. In fact, as you recall, the public address system was broken, and,
yes.
And so we had to cope with, you know, trying to deal with that without any aid from the speakers overhead and everything like that. But it worked. It was a lot of fun, and you know, I hope at the very least that I'll throw on a shirt and grab a horn and go, you know, next year.
That day particularly, I remember thinking the universe just lined up. As soon as I heard that the PA system was down, and that the band was going to end up playing a lot more than just once every six timeouts or whatever, I thought, this can't be a mistake.
It was a great afternoon. And it was so much, you know, the rehearsal was fun and the game was fun. And the, you know, and the little hang afterwards across the street was great. And it means a great deal to me that I'm even in the consideration 24 years or so after being involved in it, that, you know, that I'm still a little bit of a part of the heritage of that group. And, you know, I don't feel a lot older than I was when I was there, you know.
So a little bit more time travel. We've been time travel hopping like crazy here, but I'm kind of bouncing back to our lunch in 2001 where you said, okay, it's time to move to the next thing. And you had a location and it was Andover.
Yeah. And it was a gut-wrenching yet exciting decision. And I really didn't look back once I'd made it. And here I am teaching kids, and I'm teaching kids again and doing what I want to do. And, you know, I take my own learning experience into account when I think about what kind of teacher I want to be. And one of the things I always say to myself is that I don't teach music. I teach kids, and I am fortunate enough to have music in my life to do that. I mean, yes, music is super important, and music is, you know, a pivotal part of our lives. But when I go into the building, the priority isn't the key signature. The priority is not the correct tempo. The priority is the child and the kid showing up and what kind of experience that kid's going to have over the course of that 45 minutes, over the course of that month, over the course of grades 4 through 12. And that has to be my first priority. So kind of my way of handling that is, I'm sure not everybody that were listening, my fellow band directors, are going to agree with this little point, but I've never been crazy about when music teachers on their email signatures or on their letterheads or something sort of create this director of bands at the something when nowhere on your personnel work does it say that. Nowhere in your job description are you the director of anything. You direct bands with a little d. You are a teacher, same way that they teach math. There's nobody that the math teacher upstairs is not the director of algebra matters, or they're teaching kids, and they're teaching kids math, and I'm doing it with music. And that's always kind of the way I try to keep perspective. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm judging people that refer to themselves as the director of bands. And maybe there are places in which that is indeed their title. But even if it was my title, I still want to say I am a teacher, and what I teach it, what I use is music to teach those kids. There are some kids for whom it comes brilliantly, and they're very self-motivating, and there are some kids that it isn't, and they're all my job to teach. Right? A kid that struggles in music, a kid that struggles to pay attention, a kid that struggles to focus is not an obstacle to me. It's my job. It is my job to inspire them. It is my job to help them find that love. And I'm not always successful, but I can't look at the kid and say, man, if that kid just could stay in study hall, I could really get good things done in this school. Because the good thing I'm supposed to do in that school is inspire that kid. And I say that with all this self-righteous, where I'm not always successful, nor is it always easy to summon that. But that has to be my sort of governing dynamic. That we teach kids, we don't teach music. We use music to teach kids. And if it sounds like a big semantic thing, maybe it is. But when I tell it to myself, I know what it does to my to the way I teach, to the way I think of those kids. One really cool aspect of my career, which I think is pretty unique, that because I taught school band, and because during my first year at Boston University, I was also teaching part-time in Chelsea grades, pre-K through second grade classroom music, that in the fall of 2013 in Andover, when I was asked to teach third grade recorders, that completed my span of teaching to every single grade from pre-kindergarten through people pursuing graduate degrees. I taught every grade at least for a full year as their primary teacher, and I think that's kind of
That
hip.
is the educational royal flush.
Right, right. That's the ultimate batting for the cycle, I guess.
That's, yeah.
But to keep it student-centered and to always come back to that and remind yourself that it's about, for kid, it's sake sending them home, and how big of a part is music going to be a part of their life?
I feel like I saw that philosophy at work, and I don't know that at the time I consciously thought it, but looking back on it, in my 3 years at BU, watching you work on a fairly regular basis, the proof of that was looking around at the alumni hockey band and seeing some folks who had broken the instruments out after having not played them for a little while, in order to jump back in with this group. And you were their band director, but you were not just director of bands.
Yeah,
I'm sucking up to you good now.
no, that sounds like what I was hoping for,
I knew going into this conversation that there are plenty of topics that we can talk about that we are just, as you say, we could go for 4 hours. That's one whale of an edit. All of that means is that you just, at this point, have to become a friend of the podcast and come back and we'll do this all again, except
Right.
we'll start somewhere else. We'll start with the tuba, which I know nothing about.
Yeah, I didn't anticipate being your first four-parter or anything.
Previously on Bandwagon, the podcast. So, but before we do finish up here, I can take an opportunity to do my now usual, less resume-oriented bullet point questions. And the first one, as always, is there a favorite piece of band music that you've played outdoors or indoors?
If I think about it, if I think I look back at my at what I've done, what I've played, what I've programmed, what I've conducted, I have done multiple performances of Daniel Buckwich's Agincourt Hymn, which may be entirely unknown to a lot of the people in this. Daniel Buckwich is a very gifted composer. He's had a couple of commercially successful pieces out there. You might be familiar with Voodoo. You might be familiar with his Symphony No. 1 for Dresden, Germany. And this Agincourt Hymn, it's almost 20 minutes long. It's complicated. There are staging aspects of it. And I just fell in love with it the first time I heard it, which was when the UNH Wind Ensemble did it while I wasn't playing in it, while I was student teaching. And the first opportunity that I thought I had a band that could pull it off, I did it, and that was at BU. I did it twice in Andover on with the concert band, and then arranged it for I did a truncated version of it on the field. I wasn't even the director. It was my idea, and I was still writing for the band at the time, and when we did that. And so if I've done this piece 4 times and I'm thinking about it a lot, I really have to put that as a very likely answer to that question.
The flip side of that, what's a piece of band music that you haven't played but you'd like to?
The first one that pops to mind is Karel Huss's Music for Prague. And I've never, my only relationship with that piece, except for having heard it performed, is studying it during grad school. And I've just never had the opportunity. It's a very challenging piece, and it takes a special kind of band to do it. And, it was kind of past my days where I'm playing in bands like that for the most part. But it's a remarkable piece of music, and I would imagine that it's quite an experience to be on stage in the middle of the group for.
Talking of wish lists, is there a band that you would like to perform with that you have never, because you're either the right age, not the right age, or you're not in the right place or in the right time?
My life with my wife has brought me into the world of bagpipes and the pipe band. And I have been playing bass drum in a pipe band with her, and I love doing that. And I played tenor drum in a pipe band in Vermont, and we went to Scotland, and I've fallen in love with Inverary and District pipes and drums. They're several times world champions. They are so musical and so wonderful. And I would just, if anything ever were to befall that bass drum player, I think I could run right out and do my best to fill in for it. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Have you got a favorite band story that you would like to tell?
This will kind of bring it back to sort of my focus as my why as a teacher. In the fall of 2013, I stepped back from directing high school band. We get new staffing in Andover, and at the time there was just one band, one orchestra, and one chorus teacher for the middle schools and the high schools. And they were adding a full-time position to each discipline. So it was going to be an opportunity to bring the band down to start in the fourth grade. Not unlike the kind of deliberations I went through at the end of my time at BU about what my right course of action would be. I said, how about if I take the younger job and we search for a new high school director? And everyone thought I was nuts. Part of it was like, I hope a little bit selfless that, listen, I am going to probably have a lot easier time with all of the principals of the building and getting the elementary band program started again. I know everybody. I know the town. To find a young, really enthusiastic person to take over a high school band would probably be A, easier. You probably get a much better pool of candidates, and you have someone who's more likely to be successful, particularly if they're supported from, with an experienced teacher helping those kids find their way to high school. But selfishly, it was also happened to be the year that my son entered sixth grade. And he's doing track and baseball and cross country, and I'm desperate to be as good of a father as I can be, and maybe marching band if there was an opportunity for me to step back from that and focus on being a father and yet still give myself all to a program that fit into my life with my son, then I'll do it. But as a result of that, I had one sort of an epiphany, one moment. It was very early in the year, like probably the second or third class. I had a sixth grader come into the band room, and everyone's getting all their instruments out and getting their music ready. And this kid has not started doing that. He is rather up doodling on my whiteboard. And I'm like, well, he needs that for the moment. That's fine. Then I realize he's doodling on my whiteboard with a permanent marker.
Oh.
I'm like, oh. And I'm furious. And then I looked at him and I saw my son. And I saw, what do I need my son's teacher's reaction to be to him right now? And I looked at the kid and I said, this kid means the absolute everything in the world to somebody and deserves to be treated as such. And if, God forbid, that's not the case, then all the more reason that I need to summon the grace to handle this in a much less angry way. And I pray that I did not make profound changes in the way I approach kids on that day. I hope I just sort of got a clearer picture of why I should be that way. But I know it changed me, and I know it, I know it, and it has continued to since. And that's more to the fact that I'm teaching kids, not teaching music, And We looked up a system that if you take a dry erase marker and you pull over the permanent marker with it, then it flakes it right off, and it was no big deal. And I really would have, I know, huh? So there's your takeaway for the day.
Why was I not informed?
I know, man. I know, and so yeah, I hope somebody doesn't try that now and find I'm wrong, but it worked.
Send all your cards and letters.
Right, yeah. But that's been my big life lesson and my life, you know.
What a treat this has been. It always is when we sit down and start chewing the fat, because it's been famously now the truth can be told. It's been 29 years.
Right? I know. And we were 29 when we met, so it's half our life.
Holy Lord.
How about that?
I hate math.
Right? I know, I'm a little bit of a numerologist that way. It drives
Now that's all I'll think about.
Right.
teacher, conductor, tuba player, beekeeper. I told you there were subjects we haven't gone to.
That's correct.
Joe Wright, thanks so much for taking time for this conversation.
Absolutely my pleasure, Rob.
Okay, we'll pause briefly, and then on the other side of that, a bit more bandwagon. Thanks so much for listening. Here comes the dogfight. This week's dogfight is a return to my internet rabbit hole of the week topic. And this week we travel transatlantic to spotlight an ensemble of a sort that I foreshadowed a bit last week with my mention of the brass band tradition in England. It's the Cory Band of South Wales in the UK. Let me help you brush up on your British brass band history. The Cory Band was originally a competitive brass band named the Ton Temperance Band. There are no records of the exact date of the founding of the ensemble, but in 1895, the band was invited to play at the official opening of a library nearby to their rehearsal location. Sir Clifford Cory, the highly influential son of John Cory, performed the ceremony. He was so impressed by the standard of the band's performance that he offered to provide financial assistance and provide suitable employment to enable the band to hire a first-class conductor. The Ton Temperance Band changed its name to reflect the generous financial assistance from Sir Clifford Cory and his family business, Cory Brothers. Consequently, the band became known as Cory Workman's Band. So, naming rights agreements didn't just start with NFL stadiums in the late 20th century. The band spent that 20th century finding increasing success, both artistically and in terms of competition results. In 2001, together with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, it was appointed as resident ensemble to the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. In 2002, the band was selected to play for the Queen's Jubilee celebrations. In 2003, it performed with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra at the last night of the Welsh proms and was also featured during the opening celebrations of the new Welsh Millennium Centre. Current musical director Philip Harper was appointed in June of 2012. He's the conductor that you'll see if you watch any videos that are currently posted at the band's YouTube channel, and I will include a link to that channel in this episode's show notes, don't you worry. In 2016, the Cory Band won the Grand Slam of major titles. There were three of them, the European, the Open, and the Nationals, which was a feat that had only been achieved twice before. The Cory Band then went on to win the final major competition of the year, called Brass in Concert, redefining the meaning of the phrase Grand Slam, and becoming the only brass band in history to have achieved this four-victory honor. I will confess to you that there are things about the brass band world, notably instrumentation and what kind of sheet music the brass band musicians read, that I just flat do not understand. Put it this way, standard instrumentation includes four people playing a part called solo cornet, and there's only one lower brass instrument that reads music in the bass clef. Everybody else reads treble, and that instrument is not the tuba. Yeah, I give up. No, better yet, I really want to find someone with whom I can have a trio section conversation so I can learn about all that stuff, finally. But none of that will take away from my or your appreciation of the ferociously virtuosic musicianship of the folks in the Cory Band. They cover all the musical ground, from orchestral transcriptions to pop tunes to modern jazz classics, not to mention their covers of two items that got my attention in particular. One is the theme from the 1960s British television sci-fi classic Thunderbirds Are Go! And the other is Frank Sinatra's arrangement of My Way. Also, their YouTube channel features videos taking you behind the scenes with the band, showing rehearsals, interviewing individual players, and lots of other goodies. You will, I promise you, destroy an evening watching all this good stuff. Okay, after this brief pause, we'll tie a bow on episode 12. Thanks for staying with me. To wrap up this week, let's take the coda. For the coda this week, surely there are commencement band tales out there waiting to be told. A few episodes ago, I tossed out a conversation topic, which was this. Got any great stories from your band experience that have to do with graduation or commencement band or high school or college senior recognitions or the equivalent? Because it's that time of year. Right now, I happen to have a nephew and a niece who are those high school and college senior people, respectively, and this month I have attended and will attend many, many final concerts, presentations, awards, ceremonies, and the like. So I guess maybe I'm especially conscious of all that. But it did get me remembering going back to Letter B of Pomp and Circumstance approximately 100 times and rehearsing a college commencement band and being a senior a couple times myself. Again, surely you've got those memories too. And again, if you want to tell those stories, I want to hear them and maybe put them together in a little bouquet in a week or two. So, in mere split seconds, you can find out how to tell those stories. That's Bandwagon for this week. Thanks as always for downloading and listening. I just hit 1,000 downloads, y'all. Bandwagon was written, researched, and produced by your humble host. Musical interludes were produced by Hammerton Media from source material largely by John Philip Sousa. You can listen to more episodes at our website, heyband.podbean.com. Please give me feedback. Be polite, but let me know what you like and what you think might change. Tell me your best band story or suggest a topic for a future episode, whatever you like. You can do that using our email address, heybandwagon@yahoo.com, or leave us a 90-second voice message by going to speakpipe.com/heybandwagon. Be aware that we do reserve the right to include your message on the podcast unless you say otherwise. All those contact links and links to our news items, conversation topics, and this week's interview guest, Joe Wright, can be found in our show notes. Please share the show on social media, and thank you for that. If you enjoy this podcast, get someone else to listen as well. Word of mouth really is the best recruiting tool. And to keep up with us every week, subscribe to Bandwagon on the Podbean app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people to find the show. For now, take care, stay in touch, stay in tune, and we'll do this all again next week. I'm Rob Hammerton. Detail, where are we going to eat after rehearsal?